That's a tough act to follow. But I'll do my best. As you can see, the talk today, I titled My Unique Unity Journey. And I suspect if I went around and I talked to each of you individually, you'd all have some aspect of uniqueness about how you got here or why you got here. mine is like that, but it has a wrinkle to it, and that is that my parents actually met working for Unity in the 1930s. And because of, if it hadn't been for Unity, they likely never would have met. I mean, my dad was from a small town in northern Iowa. My mother was from a farm town on the banks of the St. Lawrence River in upstate New York. And they both got involved in Unity in the 1920s, introduced by their mother. And they both felt led to try and go to work for Unity in 1935. And so they did, showed up more or less at the same time, met. How they became a couple, I have no earthly idea, but... in any case, in 1937, in November, Charles Fillmore married them. And that's their marriage certificate. So in those days, Unity had a program where you could work there, take a few classes, and then eventually go out into what was called the field. Now, the field was run, at least in the time that I recall, it was run by a lady by the name of Elsie Shaw. And the field was really designed as anything out in the across America where there were classes, churches, sometimes they were called centers. But anyway, it was Elsie Shaw's responsibility to get people kind of coordinated and out and about spreading Unity teachings from coast to coast. So in the early 1940s, 1942 to be specific, my parents were sent to the town of Ithaca, New York. And Ithaca is where I was born. Ithaca, I don't know, for those of you that have traveled some, is a beautiful little town. My wife and I are hoping to go back there later this year because I've only been back once since I was a baby. But in any case, they stayed in Ithaca for a little while, but eventually moved to Indianapolis. This is a bulletin of the Indianapolis, it was called Unity Truth Center. You'll notice we're going to show a few bulletins from the days gone by, and you'll notice the order of service and some of the content is very much like a traditional Protestant service that you might see today. There was a benediction, there was a doxology, all the things that you expect with a typical Protestant service. In fact, there was a professor at a college in Ohio, and I can't recall the name of the college, it doesn't matter, I guess, but he wrote a thesis on Unity, and he called Unity alternative Protestantism. I've never heard that term anywhere else, but I think it's an interesting way of describing Unity. Anyway, in 1946, we moved away from Indianapolis and moved to Columbus, Ohio. I have very limited memories of Indianapolis, almost none, but Columbus I remember a fair amount about. That bulletin shows what the church looked like. It looked like a church. It had a steeple and the whole nine yards. And it was there that, like I say, I have my first early memories of Unity services. There were several things I remember about Columbus, some of which are not church-related. My dad was always a big member of the Lions Club. And those of you that are familiar with the Lions know that they have a mission in trying to help sight-impaired people, both children and those on up in years. And Columbus, being the state capital, was home to the Ohio State School for the Blind. And so I have very vivid memories of getting on a bus, going by the School for the Blind, picking up a load of kids from that school and taking them to an Ohio State football game. Now, you might say, well, why would you take blind kids to a football game? And the truth is, I don't know the answer to that, but I know they had a lot of fun. So we stayed in Columbus for 6 years. There were things about that time that I, for example, found a newspaper article on a candlelighting tradition to be observed at Unity Services, and that was a big deal. You can see we had a choir. We had men dressed up as the 12 disciples. You could come through, light your candle from the Christ candle or from a candle held by one of the men who represented all these powers that you see in the quilts all around the room. And then you would place your candle in a bed of salt. Later on, that kind of morphed into, and this may have been done here, I can't really recall, but at one point, it morphed into affirmations being wrapped around each candle that you got. So anyway, that's just to show that the candlelighting tradition in Unity has been around a really, really long time. I don't know exactly when it started, but clearly my exposure to it was this particular newspaper article, I believe was 1949 or 50, somewhere along in there. So anyway, we stayed in Columbus and for that six-year period, and during that time, for whatever reason, and I can kind of guess at it because my dad always had a sense of wanderlust. He liked to travel. He liked to see different parts of the country and the world. So we took trips out of Columbus. I remember a trip to Daytona Beach, Florida. There was a trip to Montreal. There was a trip to California. But in particular, there was a trip that took us from Columbus. We went with a church family, the Farrs, and we went into Mexico. Now, I don't remember exactly where in Mexico we were. I just remember riding on a burro and stuff like that. Anyway, so driving from Columbus to Mexico takes you across Texas. It's kind of hard to get to Mexico without going through Texas. And that seemed to begin my father's fascination with the state of Texas. He really kind of liked all things Texan and really enjoyed the culture of Texas. So if you fast forward a few years, we end up in Houston. But before Houston, there was a stop. Well, once we left Columbus, lived for a year in St. Louis. He had a church in St. Louis called Unity Christ Church. That church did not look like a church. It actually was in a big house, one of those old Victorian type of homes that you see in the center of some Midwestern cities. Yeah, but all the church services were held there. And we were there. Actually, my father, and I think it was mentioned earlier, he was president of the Unity Ministers Association. And that was the beginning in St. Louis is when his term, which was a one-year term, as president of that association, that's when it began. My mother, whose name was Donna, she would oftentimes, because he was gone a lot, he was called to Unity Village. In those days, Unity Village really wasn't called Unity Village. It was called Unity Farm. And if you happened to be there before it became a village, you would understand because they had a dairy, they had a fruit stand, actually right outside the gates of the property, where they sold apple cider and baskets of apples and milk. You could buy little bottles of milk that had the, I don't know if you anybody remembers, but they had the cream at the very top. Okay. You could buy that, so it was definitely a a spiritual center as well as a working farm in those days. Later in 1953, Unity Village became Unity Village. It incorporated, and that's when the term Unity Farm went away and Unity Village took over. Anyway, in that period of time in St. Louis, my dad was gone a lot. My mother would do the Sunday services frequently. And in those days, they had a Wednesday night service. So if he was in town, oftentimes she might do the Wednesday night service and then just assist him on Sunday when he would do the main service. So anyway, after a year in St. Louis, I guess one other thing I'll tell you about that, it has nothing to do with Unity other than, to me, it was kind of interesting. We lived in the George Washington Hotel for about 6 months. I was in the third grade. And in those days, St. Louis had streetcars. So I would have to walk about a block down from the George Washington Hotel to catch a streetcar to go to school, and it was a dime. Then we were close to what was called Forest Park in St. Louis. For those of you that are familiar with that area, in those days, and I don't know if they still do it or not, but in those days, Forest Park had opera in the middle of the summer, and you could go and take a blanket and just sit on a hillside and listen to opera. I was never a big opera buff, to be honest with everybody, but my mother really loved opera, and so we went, and I have fond memories of sitting on the hillside. Maybe not so much in the different arias, but anyway, it was a good memory. So, in the fall of 1953, and what prompted this at that time, I can't really say because I don't know. But my parents decided they wanted to come down and have a look at Houston. Actually, the initial trip to Houston was in the middle of the summer. We took the train from St. Louis down to Houston, and the concern was that if we moved to Houston, it was going to be too hot. Now, today you would never believe that, but in those days there was this superstition around that, yeah, Houston's hot. And anyway, we got down there, and my parents were amazed at all the air conditioning. And there was a fair amount of air conditioning. Not everything, but quite a bit was air conditioned. And so it was deemed that Houston would be a good place to come and start a new church. So that fall, actually, there you can see it, November the 15th, we moved down to Houston, and they started the church with offices in the Scanlon Building, which was on Main Street, really close to Josky's, if anybody remembers that. Close to Josky's and very close to the Citizens State Bank. And they would have classes in the Scanlon Building. It was on the 11th, the church offices on the 11th floor, but the Sunday services were held at Johnston Junior High. Johnston Junior High was out off of Alameda, and it was a nice school, but you know, a minute ago I said everything in Houston was air conditioned. Well, no. Schools weren't. No. So the Sunday services, it's probably a good thing they started in the fall, but after a while, even, you know, you can get some pretty warm days in fall and even in the winter. And so it was deemed that something maybe a little more comfortable in terms of seating. The chairs at Johnson Junior High, I don't know, some of you may remember the wooden chairs before we got these chairs here in Wimberley, and how comfortable or not comfortable those were. Well, the Johnson Junior High chairs were a lot like that. They were sort of theater-type chairs, but they were just solid wood. No cushioning or anything else, and so trying to find a place that was air conditioned and had more comfortable seating was deemed to be, you know, a good idea. So with that, they found And how this came about, I'm not really sure. But anyway, they were able to move the Sunday services from Johnson Junior High to a theater called Theater Incorporated. It was at 707 Chelsea Boulevard, and it had plush theater seating. It was air conditioned, and so sometime in early, I want to say sometime in the spring of 1954, the services were moved over there. You can see a little bit of what the inside of that theater looked like. That's my mother and father standing on the stage or the platform of that theater. I think it seated probably around 300 people, something like that. And it was a giant leap ahead in terms of comfort for everyone that attended Sunday services. Before we leave Johnson Junior High, and I may have messed Sue up on the slides here, but there was actually a charter Sunday that was held at Johnson Junior High. And do you have that slide? There we go. There it is. That's still that's before the move. And yours truly is in the front row there, kind of in the middle. Haven't changed a bit, have I? Going back to the Theater Incorporated, and sorry, Sue, for messing you up a little bit. Going back to that, there was it was an active playhouse. I mean, they put on plays all the time. And so typically what would happen is that the church would put out a little sort of sandwich board kind of sign out in front that with it. There, you can see it off to the side there with the name of the church. And in the back, and I don't know if you can kind of make it out a little bit in this, At this time when this photo was taken, they were putting on a production of The King and I. Well, that's fine. And nobody thought much about it. But eventually, the church purchased a big house, a kind of catty corner from the theater, which became the first owned property that the church had in the city of Houston. It was number one Chelsea Place. And at some point, someone in the church office looked out the window and saw the name of the new play that was being put on, and that play was Damn Yankees. Now, nobody was too thrilled with the name of the play. I mean, that was a little much, but beyond that, if you're familiar with the play Damn Yankees, the plot is it involves a fan of the Washington Senators baseball team. They don't exist anymore, but in those days they did. And he is such a big fan, he's willing to sell his soul to the devil if the Senators will win the pennant and the Yankees don't. Well, so not only did the sign say, Damn Yankees, there's a huge picture of the devil right behind it. Well, nobody thought this was really a good idea to have a big picture of the devil in front of Unity service. So there was a lot of scrambling that went on. And eventually, and I say eventually, it didn't take them long, 2 or 3 days, they came up with a big sign to cover up the name of the play. And so life went on, but there were some tense moments there for a little bit. Also, I wanted to mention, you saw the news article about Unity in Houston. Unity's history in Houston actually goes back to the 1920s. There was a lady by the name of Bertha Miller who lived out in the Heights, and she started Unity classes, really, in the 1920s. And eventually moved to a venue, I want to say it was a Ben Milam Hotel in downtown Houston. I could have the hotel wrong, but anyway, somewhere in the downtown area. And then in 1932, a lady by the name of Lillian Black Brass opened a Unity Center in Houston. And by the time we moved there, in late 1953, her center was still going on, but she was getting up in years. She was probably, at the time we hit Houston, if she wasn't 80, she wasn't far from it. So eventually there was a merger of the two congregations. There was a picnic held between her congregation, which was pretty small. It was like 25, 30 people. And by that time, and this was in 1955, by that time, the church that my parents had was probably averaging, I would say, between 200 and 300 every Sunday in the theater. So they had a picnic of the two congregations, and everybody got together. And Mrs. Brass announced her retirement, and with that, the two congregations merged. And they stayed with the services there at Theater Incorporated until the early 1960s, when the property was purchased. It was then called Park Drive Extension. For those of you that have seen the Unity of Houston facility, it's now on Unity Drive at the corner of Unity Drive and Hillcroft. But originally, that street was called Park Drive Extension, and it was changed to Unity Drive when the church secretary, a lady by the name of Louise Roycroft, petitioned the city council to change the name. So anyway, 1955 was a busy year for lots of different reasons. I'm backtracking a little bit. That particular summer, I came to camp in Wimberley, and my mother and father attended there was an annual conference of Unity ministers held at Unity Village. And so they went to that. As you can see, this is a postcard that my mother sent to me from Unity Village in June of that year. And when they got back, when I got back from camp and they got back, I found out shortly thereafter my mother was ill. I had no idea that she was ill, but sometime in August, she went in the hospital. They farmed me out for a little bit with a church family. And then she came home, and so I came back home when she came back home. And my last memory of her is she was in bed, and we played a game of Clue while she was in bed. The next day, she kind of was incoherent, and she went back in the hospital. And so coincidentally, shortly after this, my dad had a speaking engagement at Unity on the Plaza in Kansas City. Is sort of considered Unity's mother church. And so he and I got in a car. He was taking me with him. And we left on a Friday to go to drive to Kansas City for his speaking engagement. We got as far as Marshall, Texas, and he sensed that something wasn't quite right. So he called home and found that she was not expected to live another day. So we turned around and drove back to Houston. And I don't know how he did this or how it got arranged, but when we hit the Harris County line, there were a motorcycle officer waiting for us. And they gave us a motorcycle escort all the way to the hospital. And those were the days when children weren't allowed in hospitals, so I couldn't go in. But anyway, somebody picked me up, took me to a friend's house. I spent the night, and the next day, my dad picked me up and said she had passed away. So he went ahead. He caught a plane. He caught a plane and kept his speaking engagement in Kansas City. That was a weekend that I'll certainly never forget. If you fast forward about another year, I'm in bed, and he comes in one night into my room, and he says, "Well, how would you like a new mother?" And I said, "Do you have any suggestions for a new mother?" I said, "Well, you know, I probably think of one or two." But I said, "But I kind of like Min Chandler." She was she had been coming to church. She had grown up in Dallas. She was a registered nurse by profession. Had married a doctor together. She and her former husband had built the third house ever built on Memorial Drive in Houston. If those of you familiar with Houston, there are a lot of houses on Memorial Drive then, but now rather, but back then hardly any. And so it ended up that one night I had a friend with me, took me out to her house, and we're just kind of sitting around chatting. And he said, "Min and I have decided to go get married tonight." I said, "Oh, okay." And he, "We'd like you to be best man." Said, okay. We ended up, he had an assistant minister that he brought on board, a fellow by the name of Carol Moore. And we went to his apartment, and there we had a ceremony where I got to act as the best man. Anyway, there we are sometime later. And so I had a brand new stepmother. She eventually took all the courses required and went to Unity Village, and she became ordained herself in 1961. I don't think I mentioned, but my parents were ordained in 1946 together, but my stepmother, Min, was ordained in 1961. So, at this time, Dad was also, and it sort of started this when we first moved to Houston. He was very involved. He was a big believer in the radio. And when we first hit Houston, he had a 15-minute program on radio station KLBS. LBS stood for Liberty Broadcasting System. It's today's KILT. But anyway, back then it was KLBS. And so he would drive into downtown. Their studios were in the Milby Hotel. He'd go into downtown and broadcast the Unity Viewpoint. The scripts were actually written for Unity Viewpoint at Unity Village, but they were sent out to all the different ministries that had radio time. So you could hear the same Unity message if you were in Houston or Peoria or Miami or wherever you were, just a different voice that was delivering it. So in the course of this, he became friends with some of the disc jockeys. And one of the DJs, this is back in the days when disc jockeys would go sit on billboards to promote their show or charity or something like that. And this particular disc jockey that he became friends with had decided to do his show from the high dive in the Shamrock Hilton Hotel. Well, those of you that ever saw that pool, it was an Olympic-sized pool, and that high dive was way on up there. But anyway, he asked Dad, "Do you want to come out here and do the Unity Viewpoint from the high dive of the Shamrock Hotel?" And Dad said, "Sure." So there he went, and he, from the rest of his life, he loved telling that story. It was just something unique in his Unity ministry. Eventually, he was able to do the Unity Viewpoint from our house. They had designated a room called the prayer room, and they turned that into sort of a mini broadcast studio. And so we'd take the phone off the hook, and he'd do it from the prayer room at the house. And he did that. Eventually, KLBS was bought out, and they took all religious, or what was deemed to be religious, broadcasting off the air, and so he went on a different station at that point. Anyway, it was an interesting time, and I guess another aspect, it has nothing to do with Unity Viewpoint, I just think it's kind of interesting. Most of you, I'm going to assume, don't know that a president of the United States ever attended a Unity service. But in 1958, President Eisenhower's brother, Arthur, passed away, and that service in Kansas City was held at Unity. And so it was thought to be a really interesting development in Unity's history to have a president of the United States actually attend a Unity service. And to the best of my knowledge, it's the only time it's ever happened. But anyway, there's always a second time. Yeah. Okay. So fast forwarding a little bit. That summer, or that sometime in the late 50s, I was with my dad, and we were in Dallas, and he was really excited about something that was getting ready to come on TV. And it turned out that a Unity minister by the name of Ernest Wilson was going to be appearing on the Betty White Show. Now, there's kind of an interesting story behind this, and I'll be very brief about it. Betty White, well, Ernest Wilson was ordained by Unity, I think, in 1917, so he'd been around Unity a long time, and eventually started a Unity church in Los Angeles and started a radio program out there. The manager of the radio station was a fellow by the name of Don Federson, who later on produced, I think, My Three Sons and some other fairly well-known shows. But they were coming up with this idea for kind of a variety program, and originally it was going to feature a fellow by the name of Al Jarvis, and Betty White was going to be sort of a sidekick to Al Jarvis. And so that happened, but they approached Ernest Wilson about being part of the regular cast. But in order to do that, he had to agree to wear a collar. He also had to agree to not mention Unity, because they felt that if it seemed like a promotion of Unity, then it would open the door for other people to come in and want equal time. So he had to agree, A, to wear a collar, B, to never say anything about Unity. So anyway, my dad was just really excited that this was happening. Eventually, Al Jarvis left the show to try and go national. Betty White took it over. Then she ends up going national, and she ended up taking Ernest Wilson with her, and he appeared on a regular basis on her show. And she stayed apart in Unity. How active she was in actually going to services, I really don't know. But she, if you look at her bio, she stayed clearly focused on Unity principles her entire life. So I just think that's an interesting connection. Okay, in 40s into the 1960s, Rosemary Fillmore Ray, who was the granddaughter of Charles and Myrtle Fillmore, came up with an idea for a TV show. And this show was called The Word, and it kind of came about in an interesting way. She and her husband, Ralph Ray, were at a hotel in Southern California. They ran into Robert Wagner, the actor. And they found out in talking to him that Robert Wagner's mother read Daily Word. Well, out of that came this desire to do a TV program called The Word, and it was 1 minute in length. And so We've got a few clips from the Word that Sue is now going to show us.
No, I'm going to stand back over here.
One encounter, one disturbing moment, and the harmony is gone. Maintaining peace and harmony requires practice. If a musician in an orchestra plays the wrong note or is out of time, a good conductor hears it immediately and calls attention to it, making it right again. Try starting each day with the real intention of being harmonious with everything in your life. And then remember that you are the conductor who maintains the harmony and rhythm.
For your free copy of Words from Unity, write Unity Television, Unity Village, Missouri.
The late 50s also saw a good bit of activity on my part in the YOU group. And here's a picture of a group of us that did a service like this one in 1959. That same group went on and attended conference that year at Unity Village. And on that photo, and the reason I'm including that is, I'm in the upper left with my eyes closed, but that's not, that's not the reason I'm including it. Bonnie Armstrong is the lady seated on the bottom on the far right. She was the director of all the children's activities for Unity at that time. And so she coordinated, you know, Sunday school lessons that went out and YOU activities and that kind of thing. But she also founded something called the Good Words Booster Club, which had a motto, good, better, best, I'll never let it rest till my good is better and my better is best. And that was mainly for younger kids. But if you were a member of the Good Words Booster Club, and you were certainly strongly encouraged to be one, you got a little gold pin that looked like the three monkeys. Hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil. And anyway, that was a significant step in adhering to the principles of the Good Works Booster Club. At that conference, we also had a chance to attend a Unity Band concert. It's probably little known today, but in those days, Unity had a band. And it was led by, from 1927 until he passed away in 1967, a fellow by the name of Carl Frankeiser. One of his claims to fame, other than being the leader of the Unity Band, was he played cornet in Buffalo Bill's Wild West show. And he also played in the Barnum and Bailey Circus Band at one point. So anyway, he was director of radio, so a lot of the scripts for Unity Viewpoint that went out and a lot of the music that went into the Unity hymnal were a result of Carl Frankeiser and his input into the music that Unity offered in those days. Also in those days, there was a fellow around by the name of Marcus Bach. And Marcus Bach was a professor of religion at the University of Iowa. And he had an intense interest in Unity. He had actually been ordained as an evangelical minister and had a church in Kansas for, I think, a couple of years. But eventually, on scholarship, went to the University of Iowa to study playwriting in the beginning. And that morphed into a position as a professor of religion at the University of Iowa. And in that, he met a lot of interesting people. He met Schweitzer, he met the Pope, he just met all kinds of people, but he was especially intrigued with the Fillmores. Charles Fillmore was still alive at the time. And he took the minister of the First Methodist Church in Iowa City to meet the Fillmores, and he liked to tell the story of how that Methodist Church in Iowa City was transformed by that minister going to Unity Village, meeting with the Fillmores, and seeing what was going on within Unity, and how the congregation, the Methodist congregation in Iowa City at that time, grew from 400 to over 2,000 when this minister started implementing some of the things that he had learned by traveling with Marcus Bach. And this is a quote from Marcus Bach, which I came across, and I think it says a lot. It's no modern religious movement has made more of an impact upon American faith than the Unity School of Christianity. No emerging group has been so widely accepted by a large number of Protestants and Roman Catholics. No new group has so impressively got its literature into Christian homes. No new group has appealed to the unchurched as strongly as Unity has in its 50 years of history. So, I think that says a lot. I found another quote by him, and I won't read it, but it basically said that when he first started studying Unity, he thought that Unity needed to catch up with the rest of the churches. He later came to understand the churches needed to catch up with Unity. So, anyway, pushing on, I'm going to show you a brief article. This is Min, my stepmother, and Unity in those days had dial-a-prayer. A lot of Unity churches did, and some non-Unity churches had dial-a-prayer. You would basically call in. There would be a recording that would, you'd have a little message. And then you could leave if you had something that you needed to talk to someone one-on-one about. You could leave a message and someone would get back to you. There's a copy of that particular newspaper article out in the fireside room, if anyone is interested in taking a closer look at it. Anyway, fast forward, and 1963, my parents surprised me and said they were going to move and take a church in Vancouver, British Columbia. And I think that it was tied in more or less to my dad's sense of wanderlust. He just liked new things. The church in Unity had put up in Houston had put up its first building. It had acquired its property out on Hillcroft, And I think he just felt it was kind of time to move on. So in late 1963, they did move to Vancouver. Just prior to that, he was part of a group along with Eric Butterworth, Hal Rosencrantz, and a fellow by the name of Charles Pierce. Those were the four original trustees for the Association of Unity Churches. And there's a copy of the Articles of Incorporation out in the Fireside Room if anybody's interested in that. So they move. I was in college at the time, and so there was never any question of my moving to Vancouver. It just wasn't going to be in the cards. And I had a support group around me of Unity friends. So it wouldn't have been my first choice to see them move away. It ended up being really good for them, and it was probably good for me. I probably had to grow up a little quicker than I would have under other circumstances. In 1964, and this was after they had gone to Vancouver, Unity celebrated its 75th anniversary, and they had as speakers Norman Vincent Peale, who came out. I went up for that. My parents came down from Vancouver. I drove up and to hear Norman Vincent Peale, and they also had John Payne, who people may know from Miracle on 34th Street, and Mala Powers, who played Roxanne in Cyrano de Bergerac. So they were speakers along with Norman Vincent Peale. So it was quite a celebration in 1964 at Unity Village. Fast forward a few years, and we get to the early 70s back in Houston. And John Rankin, by this time, is the minister of Unity in Houston and has decided that he wants to build a pyramid-shaped sanctuary. And some of you that have been to Unity in Houston know that, what that building looks like, and it's still there. At the time, a pyramid-shaped sanctuary was, gave some people pause for thought. So the way John explained it is, well, if you think about the geometry of a pyramid, it's basically a triangle, and a triangle has three sides, and there are four sides to the pyramid, so you have 12 things pointing up to a common top, so that's the equivalent of the 12 disciples pointing up to Christ. So when he put it that way, people began to accept it. But it was originally thought of as, I don't know, but anyway, it flew, and that pyramid for years was the scene of a lot of growth. John was a dynamic speaker, followed by Sig Paulson and later by Howard Caesar, and the congregation just kept growing and growing and growing over the years. So I skipped over the fact that in 1972, my father passed away. He went in the hospital in Vancouver in October of 1971, he never left the hospital. He was there until February of 72 when he passed away. And he had written an article for a publication called Weekly Unity entitled All Healing is Divine. And if you read that article, it basically made the point that medicine, all knowledge in medicine, is really derived spiritually from a divine component that has given wisdom and knowledge to the medical community. And so you would think that he might take that to heart and do so, but he actually kept delaying his own physical situation until it basically was too late for him to do anything. And so I can't explain that other than I just encourage everybody to use the knowledge, the spiritual gifts that are there in the medical community to keep up with your own health and well-being. I think that's important. So it's time for me to wrap this up. We came to Houston. We came to Wimberley. We moved. There's an interim move. We had to Fort Wayne, Indiana, where we were a part of Fort Wayne Unity for a while, and they had an interesting thing called the Clown Ministry, where they had a group of people in the congregation that dressed up as clowns and would go out to different nursing and retirement homes, that kind of thing, and entertain people. It's the only Unity church I've ever known that had a clown ministry, but it's another example of the creativity that you'll find in this church. So in 2003, we moved here. It just happened to coincide. There was a front page article on Unity when we moved here about a blessing of animals that was going to take place outside the Harmony House with the Unity study group at the time. And so we went to that, and then eventually to Buddy and Holly Wilson's barn, and then eventually out here. So in conclusion, I guess I'd just like to talk a little bit about the enduring value of Unity teachings, and I can only speak for myself in this respect. But I suspect there's a kind of a common thread among longtime Unity people when it comes to this. For me, Unity values and teachings have provided a toolbox for leading a productive life with the capability to overcome those moments we would all rather not deal with. It's up to each of us to access those tools. They'll just stay in the box unless we go to the trouble of pulling them out and putting them to use. These tools can provide, among other things, peace in the face of turmoil, prosperity in the face of lack, health in the face of illness, confidence in the face of uncertainty, and a sense of inner freedom unlike any other. And in this week where our country is celebrating our 247th anniversary as a nation, we also celebrate the freedom that Unity principles provide each of us as we seek and explore our own unique spiritual pathways. Our journey in embracing and using these pathways can enrich us each day when we stay focused in the knowledge and the potential of our indwelling Christ Spirit. I want to thank you for listening. I wish everyone a happy 4th of July. And Michael Finn is now going to lead us in meditation, I think. We're not doing that. Okay. I have waxed on a little bit longer.